From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, the proposed Rosemont Copper Mine in the Santa Rita Mountains has been a source of controversy since it was announced. Today, we present a special focus on both the plans for the new mine and the arguments against it. First, Tony Paniagua visits the proposed site for the Rosemont Mine, which is about 30 miles southeast of Tucson in the Santa Ritas, to look at the impact the mine could have on the surrounding area. Then we'll hear from both sides on this highly charged issue in a debate moderated by Bill Buckmaster. Also on today's show, longtime NPR journalist and host Scott Simon. I'll talk to him about his latest work, a humorous political novel called Windy City, as well as the real-life politics in his hometown of Chicago and more. That's coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Mining has played an important but controversial role in our state's history. The first precious metal to be found in Arizona was gold. In 1857, a prospector named Jacob Snively struck gold near Gila City. Although Gila City was Arizona's first boomtown, these days it's just a ghost town. But mining would become Arizona's most profitable resource, and along with the gold and silver came the mineral that now drives the industry in our state, copper. Today, copper is selling for record prices, and the ever-increasing need of industry for more copper is the driving force behind plans to open a new mine. Next, Tony Paniagua tours the property that is right at the heart of the controversy.
The proposed Rosemont Copper Mine is slated to be built in these rolling hills about 30 miles southeast of Tucson. It's a rural area in the Santa Rita Mountains that many people have discovered from Highway 83, a scenic route which connects to Interstate 10. The operation is named after Rosemont Ranch, which has been here for decades but was bought by Augusta Resource Corporation, a Canadian company, in 2004. The 995 acres of the ranch make up an island of private land surrounded by U.S. Forest Service property, which explains their involvement in the process. Augusta wants to use about 4,000 acres of public lands to be able to build and operate their facility. The open-pit copper mine has a proposed lifespan of 18.2 years. The land is said to have a world-class deposit of copper, with an estimated 7.2 billion pounds of the mineral, according to the company's studies. Here's the annual mining goal: about 220 million pounds of copper, 4.5 million pounds of molybdenum, an alloy which is used to strengthen lightweight metal, and 2.7 million ounces of silver. Getting to the resources will require hundreds of people, approximately 1,500 for the initial construction, followed by a permanent employee workforce of about 500 during the life of the mine. Augusta predicts an average wage of about $59,000 a year and a local economic impact of at least $250 million annually. If the plan is approved, this land will have a waste rock and upper perimeter berm to deposit limestone and other materials that can't be used. East of that is the pit where the actual mining operation will take place. A plant site where the ore is processed and turned from about 0.5% copper to a concentration of about 30% copper. Also necessary, a dry stack tailings and a lower perimeter berm. Company officials say they will conduct a state-of-the-art facility with the latest in environmental technology. They will continue to operate a ranch with 500 head of cattle and maintain access to public lands whenever possible. But opponents worry about environmental impacts like traffic, air pollution, degradation of the land, and water use. Augusta plans to use about 30 large trucks with a capacity to haul 260 tons each. And in order to conduct its operations, it's predicting 1.6 billion gallons of water will be needed every year. And even though they say they plan to recharge it, opponents aren't impressed with that promise. They say the water should not be pumped from the aquifer to begin with, and they worry about the impact to surrounding regions miles away. Rosemont's adversaries also question the economic benefits. They say that if the mine depresses tourism by just 1% in Pima and Santa Cruz counties, that will cost more than the mine's estimated payroll. They also charge that the mine's impact is relatively short-term and unsustainable compared to protecting the land, which can last forever. Right now, the proposed Rosemont Copper Project is being analyzed as part of NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which includes the Environmental Impact Study. A decision from the federal government isn't expected until next year. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
Next, we'll hear from two guests with contrasting perspectives on what the opening of the Rosemont mine could mean. Kathy Arnold is the Director of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for Rosemont Copper. Gail Hartman is an anthropologist and president of the citizens group called Save Our Scenic Santa Ritas. The debate is moderated by Bill Buckmaster.
Cut to the bottom line on this, Kathy Arnold. What is the most compelling reason for this mine?
The most compelling reason is we need the copper. Rosemont will provide 5% of the nation's copper for 20 years, and we're going to do it differently than before. So we have an opportunity to do it right and get all the public input to do it that way.
And Gail Hartman, the most compelling reason not to have this mine?
Well, there's lots of reasons, but I think water, the effects on water quality and water quantity are probably the biggest. The water quantity issue, I mean, right now Augusta is drilling test wells not too far from the mine along Sahuarita Road. And the people who live there, their wells, their residential wells, are being impacted. Some of them are dropping in water level. I think a few have actually dried up. In the future, there's a convoluted plan that the mine would try to use CAP water, and that they would bring CAP water into the community to make up for the water they're using, and that they would, of course, use the better quality groundwater. It doesn't look like any of these plans would work. The CAP water, as I understand it, would go to community, the Green Valley, I think it's called Community Water Company, which serves less than half of Green Valley. So I don't think that the water losses will be made up. And CAP water is not an inexhaustible supply. You know, we all know the Colorado is taxed beyond its limit now. Then to look at the other side of the mountain, the water quality issue, that would be on the east side where the mine is. The mining company says that they will certainly put in various liners and, you know, keep toxics from overflowing. But in the past, that has just seldom been the case. There's about 40% of headwaters in the country now that are polluted from mines. And toxics can flow out during stormwater events. They would go into Davidson Canyon and Cieniga Creek, which we, the taxpayers, have paid a lot of money to protect, eventually probably possibly into the Tucson Basin.
Okay, so you're bringing up really two water issues here, water quality and water quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to address the first one of the water? Let's address the water quantity issue.
Water quantity.
Is there enough water to handle this project?
Yes, there is. Gail made an interesting point about water wells going dry in the local community, and we've done some test pumping there, but we haven't installed production wells that we're using for production. The well that went dry, so to speak, the gentleman's pump actually broke, and we were in the process of making sure that he had water. So that's the only complaint that we got, and we actually rectified that for him, replaced his pump, and he was very happy. So we had no water go dry. We're going to put back 105% of what we use. We've already purchased cap allocations and have put some water back into the basin now. Unfortunately, there wasn't room at the Pima Mine Road recharge station, so we had to go to Marana. But we're working to get the water into the Green Valley, Sahuarita area so that we can actually use it down there, and it's just a question of recharge space.
So now that's about the quantity, and I'll come back to the CAP in a moment here,
but okay.
What about the quality of water will be diminished with this project?
We've done testing, and we're still in analysis. We actually have tested 6,500 feet of drill core, which is to show what our waste rock is going to be, and we found that only 3% has a acid generation, and 25% is potentially acid generating. So that's a real manageable number for us. 75% of the rock on site is not going to cause any environmental problems. So what we're doing is looking at it. We're doing additional test work. We've got some geochemists working on it, and we've decided to meet or exceed all prescriptive bad cat requirements for the state.
Do you find though, Ms. Hartman, that they are hoping that Central Arizona Project water will come through for them, but it might not. Isn't that true?
Well, that's an issue that's of considerable concern to us. We really don't think there is enough water. And we're also concerned about this trade-off of giving CAP water to the residences and then using the groundwater for the mine. And the reason for that is that, you know, the groundwater is actually sort of better quality and is more stable. It doesn't have changes in its chemical content, I guess. so that the mine would prefer to do that. But a month or so ago, I went to a meeting at a church in Sahuarita that was packed with about 400, really, I guess I'd say, terrified people who live in the area of these wells. Incredibly concerned about the damage that might happen to their wells. The Pecan Grove folks have now hired an attorney because they're concerned about the water loss that, you know, may put them out of business. So I fear that there just isn't enough water to go around no matter how you cut this, and that the mine would be the winner and other people, residences, would be the losers.
You want to address some of those concerns?
Yeah.
Are you confident, though, there will be the CAP water for you?
We're as confident as we can be. I mean, there's no guarantees in life on anything, but we have purchased the allocations. We'll move forward to continue to purchase the allocations, and as long as there's water available to purchase, we're going to do it. Now, that's the plan.
What if you were not able to get those? What if those purchases were denied? Would that kill the mine project?
No, it wouldn't kill the mine project. We'd have to look at other ways to conserve water, other offsets. We can purchase other people's CAP allocations. There are a lot of opportunities out there. And to look at only the downsides is an incorrect way to go about it. You have to look for solutions, not only problems.
Well, I want to leave one of the water certainly is one of the big issues here. Mm-hmm. I want to leave that for a moment and go back to economics, because you said basically this is the most compelling reason we need mm-hmm. this. We need copper. Mm-hmm. Copper hit $4. A record price yesterday. What is it?
$4
a pound. Yes, I was going to say an ounce, but no, it's
$4.
$4 a pound, record. So, is this what's driving the project? The economics? Is this why Rosemont is so involved with this?
Absolutely, it's a part of it. I mean, it's a company; it's there to make money, but it's not. It's not the only reason. I mean, we're a copper company. That's what we'll do: is produce copper. You'd want to do it at a profit, of course. And if you couldn't do it at a profit, then it wouldn't be happening. But $4 a pound isn't necessary to make this project profitable.
When you hear about all this, about the economics, what's your reaction, Gail Hartman?
Well, there's several ways to look at it. One is, let's just look at the company for a moment. It is a Canadian company. One of the big investors is Japanese Sumitomo. So a lot of the money that will be generated will clearly go to investors in the company. And where will the copper go? Well, the Augusta staff has said in public that it will go primarily to Asia, to China. So I don't think the American economy is going to be benefited by the copper. We've just had a big mine in Dos Pobres just opened near Safford, which, as I understand it, is a lot bigger than this mine would ever be, and will be supplying, you know, more copper. Whether it goes to the U.S. or Canada, you know, I can't say. But I think the copper is going is probably not here. But from the other economic point of view, the one that's, I think, really disturbing to a lot of us is what impact this will have on the little communities nearby, Patagonia, Elgin, Sonoita. These are now what are often called amenity communities or knowledge-based communities, and they rely on people who sit home and work on their computers or wineries or bed and breakfasts or whatever. And they are terrified that all the noisy trucks and the pollution and the various things that will be involved with this mine, the big hole in the ground, will deter people from coming down that road and will hurt their economy. And there was a piece in your setup that if only 1% of the tourism dollar is impacted there, that would be greater than the annual income of the mine. So it doesn't seem like a very good balance.
Kathy Arnold addressed this degradation, the possible degradation of small communities like Patagonia and these communities in Santa Cruz County.
Well, I think that it's overstating. I think that if there was a problem with mining communities alongside of a roadway, you would see problems with Tubac and Green Valley. I mean, Tubac is flourishing. There's no reason that Elgin or Patagonia or Sonoita should be affected by a mine that's alongside of a road for a drive for 3 minutes.
Noise is a problem? Do you see that as a problem?
We're looking into that. That's something that was raised at one of our community meetings, and noise is potentially something that we need to address more fully. We've had a bunch of community meetings with people, little sit-downs, what's your concern kind of things, to be sure that our process is very robust, and that was one comment that was raised, and we are doing some surveys.
Let's talk about the noise situation, mm-hmm. Gail.
Well, the mine, as I understand it, would operate 24 hours a day, every day of the year. Trucks would go out about one every 10 to 15 minutes on big trucks along this little narrow two-lane scenic highway, which now mostly is used by commuters, recreational vehicles, and school buses. So that's going to clearly be an impact on the traffic, on the vicinity, the noise and the frequency of trucks. There's blasting, of course, other things like that. The people who live very nearby in these Singing Valley communities, as they're called, they are, let me tell you, scared to death. They're already seeing their property values drop. They say they don't feel that they can sell their houses now. So there's a lot of issues, along the way of noise, light pollution, maintenance of the highway, for instance. It's going to be the Pima County taxpayers, presumably, that'll get stuck for keeping this highway up to so it can handle all these trucks. So I think there are, a lot of issues that will be awfully difficult to resolve.
As far as precedent for mining on that land, how far? I understand that particular mine where you're looking at, there's precedent for mining in that area?
Back to the 1800s. There's been mining. It was named a mining district in the early 1800s. So it's Helvetia Mining District. So it predates a lot of the communities around here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you would say to that, Gail Hartman?
Well, that's true. It was a mining district. I actually worked on some of the archaeological projects earlier that were mitigation for previous mines in that area. There was a Sarco before that. It was Animax, probably another one before that. But the interesting thing is none of those companies actually mined to speak of, I don't think at all, which makes you wonder, was there some problem there, either not enough copper or they couldn't get the water or whatever it was, so that now somebody is trying again. But it seems like it must not be as fruitful a place as Augusta would like us to think.
Well, and I have to disagree. There were two smelters on that site, so there was enough ore to actually create smelters, and it was a large mining district. It's not an unmined area. You can go out and see the mines that were there. And the reasons prior companies didn't mine, that's an entirely economic decision that they would have made. So it has nothing to do with us.
Gail Hartman, in one sentence, why should this project not go forward?
It's not in the best interests of the people of Southern Arizona.
And Kathy Arnold, one sentence, why this project should go forward?
We need the copper, and we can do it better.
The next public open house meetings to discuss the mine proposal are being held next week. The first is Tuesday, April 22nd, from 6 to 8 at the Sarita High School cafeteria in Sarita. Then the following day, Wednesday, April 23rd, another meeting is scheduled for the Elgin Elementary School in Elgin. Public hearings are also scheduled for May and June. For a copy of the schedule or to comment on the mine proposal, you can find a link to the U.S. Forest Service online at KUAZ.org. There's more Arizona Spotlight coming to you right after this break. Journalist and author Scott Simon started his career at NPR in 1977. He's won many major awards for his reporting and filed stories of every type from all 50 states and at least 5 continents while covering 8 wars for NPR News. Somehow, he's also found time to write books, including 2 about his favorite sport, baseball. His latest book is a political comedy called Windy City. It follows the aftermath of the sudden death of the mayor of Chicago and the struggle of the city's vice mayor to stay in control during the political storm that follows. I talked to Scott Simon about Windy City and what led him to want to write a novel of politics.
Well, it's so damn entertaining, isn't it? I think we can see that in this election year. I wondered after I'd written a novel about the siege of Sarajevo called Pretty Birds, which was, I'd say, 80% serious, 20% comedy. But the 20% that was comedy was important to me because I think for people living in besieged circumstances in the middle of a war, comedy is not only often the first but last resort that they have for their own defense. I wanted to write a novel after that sort of reversed those proportions, 80% comedy, 20% serious. But I think the 20% that's serious in Windy City about the political system is also important because it gives you a reason to turn the page. It gives, I think, the story some resonance. And I thought Chicago was just the best place to set it because I think politics is a local specialty in Chicago alongside of improvisational comedy and the blues. And in fact, it often has a lot in common with improvisational comedy and the blues.
Well, tell us how.
I think when you sit in a large assembly like the Chicago City Council, now imagine, the Chicago City Council is half as large as the U.S. Senate. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You have 50 city councilmen. So the opportunity for byplay and hijinks is utterly extraordinary. Yet at the same time, I think the like in blues or improvisational comedy, you can see something being worked out. You can see business being done. You get a sense that that at some level this is the business of the people that's being accomplished, even though a lot of it is spontaneous and worked out, and it's not worked out beautifully in advance, but something that you work out in the hurly-burly of actually doing something. That's part of what I love about improvisational comedy and blues and jazz, for that matter, and I think it definitely applies to local politics. I also think Chicago is probably the most emblematic of American cities. If you had set this story in, let's say, New York or Los Angeles, it would have been just as valid, except I think people often will take a story set in New York or Los Angeles and say, well, that's just L.A. or that's just New York.
Mm-hmm.
You put something in Chicago, it infers something about America. And it's irresistible to point out now we have an election year where the two principal candidates for the Democratic nomination for president are Chicagoans.
So you're seeing elements of Chicago politics coming into play in the national campaign this year?
I must say I see it reflected most significantly for the moment right now in the way the Obama campaign and David Axelrod, who's Mayor Richard M. Daley of Chicago's longtime campaign manager, the way David Axelrod and Barack Obama understood that caucuses were going to be important, that you could win a state caucus in a place like Iowa with relatively small number of voters, and you could wind up saying, well, we won Iowa, making it sound as if you obviously won a big election in that state.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was a huge victory, but they were a caucus victory. I think they understood the importance of the caucuses and amassing delegates in the caucuses in a way the Clinton campaign, at least so far, has not. And I think that's definitely Chicago training.
Talking about the comedy element in your book, let me ask you, when you were writing it, when did you know if you had a laugh on the page?
You know, I'm insufferable this way. I'm probably insufferable in a number of ways. But if I made myself laugh at first, sometimes aloud, I thought that was a good sign. And then I, of course, would inevitably try it on my wife, who has a very keen sense of humor. And I know a lot of people out there are thinking, well, yes, any woman married to you would have to have a keen sense of humor, not to mention a touch of masochism. But in any event, she has a very keen sense of humor. And more to the point, of course, my wife is French. So you get her to laugh, it's quite an accomplishment. Particularly writing a thoroughly American book. So I thought it would be broad enough that people would understand it. At least I hoped and trusted. Remember, my father was a comedian. So I think you have to have an internal sense of comedy. I mean, you never know, obviously, until you read something aloud. But mm-hmm. I think you have to have an internal sense of comedy. And I never forget, for one reason or another, how my father, who could laugh a lot, but when he heard a line that he thought was particularly funny, he wouldn't just laugh. In fact, sometimes he wouldn't laugh. He would just go, now that's funny. As if in stupefied appreciation, now that's funny.
Well, at one point there's a revelation that characters who got notes from the mayor could occasionally ignore these requests based on the color of the ink, that being a secret code as to whether or not it was an actual request or something being done for show. Right. Was that based on anything you've run across in real life?
It's interesting you should ask, yes. I read a book years ago, Franklin P. Moley, who had worked for Franklin D. Roosevelt at the White House, said that Jim Farley, who had been Postmaster General of the United States and a politician, when somebody came to Farley and asked him for a federal job, could you please recommend me for a federal job? If the letter was in black ink, you knew you could pay attention. If it was in blue ink, you knew you could disregard it. So that way he always got credit for writing the letter, and somebody who felt indebted to him for a favor. On the other hand, the person receiving the letter had different instructions. And it's interesting because, you can put a letter like that through literally the orange juice squeezer. I mean, you can ask the FBI labs to take a look at it and say, what's going on here? But the clue in the end turns out to be something as stunningly simple as that, the color of the ink.
Have you ever been tempted to write a novel based around broadcasting or journalism?
No. And I'm actually glad that you asked the question, because I think on principle, I do not put reporters in my novels. Maybe they're seen from a distance, as they are in Windy City. I have the mayor, who dies on the first page of the novel, mm-hmm. refer to them as the chihuahuas, because they're small, smelly, noisome. They yap at the feet of the great and mighty, yap at their ankles, as a matter of fact. I have avoided putting reporters in books. I didn't in the Siege of Sarajevo book that I did, Pretty Birds. I think there's something wrong in writing a novel in which journalists are the narrative center. I think that's not why I want to write novels. Any journalist who really is honest about it has to admit that at the end of the day or the night, at some point the door closes, the curtain comes down, the people actually involved in a story are left by themselves. The journalist goes home, or the journalist flies out of town, or the journalist goes back to his or her hotel room. And I think it's important to remember that, because journalists do not share the same stakes in the outcome of stories that people actually affected by those stories do. And I want to write novels that reflect real lives. And I think it's humbling as a journalist. You do the best job that you can to understand a story, but I think we kid ourselves when we begin to think that we understand it too well. And certainly from the perspective of the people who were actually involved, the perspective of the press is a small and even limiting thing. So it's important to me not to put journalists in stories, because I think it limits the depth and reach of the material.
You can visit KUAZ.org to hear more of this interview with Scott Simon, including more about his novel and his comments about his beloved Chicago Cubs and their upcoming season. It's all online at KUAZ.org. And now here's Stephanie Varney with a look at some events happening around Tucson this weekend.
Live theater workshops, late night series, etc. will be performing Closer. The story follows the romantic entanglements and betrayals of four Londoners. Closer starts this Friday at 10:30 p.m. Also this Friday is the start of the 2008 Arizona International Film Festival, which includes 80 films from all over the world from many different genres. The festival runs April 27th. For schedules and location information, visit filmfestivalarizona.com. The third annual Bollywood at the Fox is this Saturday. The festivities start at 5 p.m., including an Indian street fair, or mela, music, dancing, food, beverages, and desserts, as well as Bollywood films. This weekend, along with the Pima County Fair and Club Crawl, check out Relay for Life. Relay for Life raises money to help fight cancer, celebrates survivors, and remembers those who have been lost. The relay will start this Friday at Saguaro High School at 6 p.m., the University of Arizona at 8 p.m., and other locations around Tucson. For more information, visit relayforlife.org. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Stephanie Varney.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran and Stephanie Varney. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. The music heard on this program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Podcasts of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.